All right. This is time and place for hearing the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, North Coast Region, to consider public hearing order number R1-2009-0047. This item has been properly noticed. She explained the procedures for this hearing is available at their handout table. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand? Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter? Thank you. We'll begin with the staff presentation. Matt St. John.
Thank you, Board Chair, members of the board. My name is Matt St. John. I'm the lead staff for the TMDL development unit, and this is the unit that also does the water quality assessments in support of the Federal Clean Water Act, Section 305B and 303D list updates, which is the topic that we're here to present today. Catherine Carter of the TMDL Development Unit staff is going to give the beginning of this presentation, and then I will make some additional presentation.
Good afternoon, Chairman Anderson, members of the board.
I'm sorry, but we have to say we have to say that there was a previous staff member who worked on this project who just walked in.
Oh,
so this was her. This project was her baby, and then she decided she needed to have a real baby. Thanks for coming, Rebecca.
And she doesn't know, but I'm going to tell her to come up, and I'll hold Matthew, so come on. As Matt said, my name is Catherine Carter, and I'm going to be doing the first part of the presentation today. I wanted to point out the pieces that you have for this item. There's the executive officer's summary report, and also the resolution for this item. We also have an errata sheet that was made that just points out that there was an omission of the mention of South Fork Eel River in the discussion on the aluminum listings in Appendix D. And finally, the pièce de résistance, the staff report for the 2008 integrated report, which has our 305B report and our 303D list recommendations. Here's the outline of the presentation we're going to be giving today. I'll start out by describing there's a new format for the 303D list that's new for 2008. I'll also be giving a brief overview of the 303D list and what it is. I'll be discussing the assessment process that we use to come up with our listing and delisting recommendations. And then I'll be turning it over to Matt, and we'll be having a discussion of some of those recommendations, followed by board discussion and public comment and board action. In past years, the 303D list was its own standalone document. However, this is the first year that the 303D list has been integrated into a larger document called the 2008 Integrated Report, which is this one that I just held up. The 2008 Integrated Report is comprised of the 305B Surface Water Quality Assessment and the 303D List of Impaired Waters. Under Clean Water Act Section 305B, states are required to report every other year to the United States Environmental Protection Agency on the water quality conditions, both impaired and non-impaired, of all the surface waters. The US EPA then compiles these assessments into the biennial National Water Quality Inventory Report to Congress. The focus of today's discussion, however, is going to be on the 303D portion of this document. Staff are going to be presenting what our recommendations for the 2008 303D list of impaired waters for your consideration and approval. The Clean Water Act Section 303D requires that states identify waters that are not meeting water quality standards after application of certain point source technology-based controls, such as primary and secondary wastewater industrial treatment controls. So basically, the list identifies waters that are not supporting basin plan beneficial uses. The list includes a description of the pollutants that are causing the violation of water quality standards and a priority ranking of the water quality limited segments. States review the list every 2 years and make changes as necessary and submit it to the US EPA for their approval. Placement of a water body on the 303D list generally triggers the development of a TMDL, or total maximum daily load. Before I get into the details of the 303D list recommendations and the assessment process, I wanted to go over some of the terms that you'll be hearing used today. The listing policy, it's a document developed by the State Water Board that establishes the methodologies that the regional boards are supposed to follow for developing their 303D lists, and it includes the process for gathering and evaluating readily available data, as well as TMDL scheduling. The State Water Board developed and adopted the list in 2004, and this is the first time that we are working closely with this list, although the State Board did use it in their 2006 listing cycle when they did the 303D list in 2006. The State Water Board regulations require an environmental review equivalent to a CEQA review, accompany any policy that is proposed for State Water Board adoption. And the State Water Board developed what is termed the functionally equivalent document, which is the second bullet there. The functionally equivalent document to the listing policy fulfills this environmental review requirement. And it contains a brief description of all the alternatives that were considered for inclusion in the listing policy, as well as a discussion of the preferred alternative and why it was used. The term water body pollutant pair refers to a water body segment that is in discussion, as well as the pollutant in question for that water body segment, such as the Klamath River listing for sediment or the Eel River listing or delisting for temperature. And finally, fact sheets. A fact sheet is comprised of a decision, which is whether to list, delist, etc., and the lines of evidence that were utilized to support that decision. Fact sheets have been developed for each water body pollutant pair. And Appendix A of the 2008 Integrated Report contains fact sheets for the water body and pollutant pairs that staff are recommending be delisted or listed in 2008, plus any that we thought would be of particular interest. Today I'll be reviewing staff's recommendations for the current, staff's modifications for the current 2006 303D list. So therefore, the 2006 303D list is the baseline from which we'll be making all of our recommendations. Modifications to the 2006 303D list are made through the process of delistings and listings. A delisting means to take the water body pollutant pair off of the 303D list, while listing means to place the water body pollutant pair on the 303D list. And the end result of all these modifications will be the new 2008 303D list, which the board will be considering for adoption here today. So although regions are still in the process of developing and adopting their updates to the 2008 303D list, the State Water Board has termed the cycle 2008, even though we're fully aware that we're into 2009. The process, I believe, is taking a bit longer than expected. The California Water Quality Assessment Database was developed to organize, store all the data and information that was utilized in this assessment process. It's new for the 2008 listing cycle, and this is the first time the database has been used. It allows us to have a much more transparent process in our list development, as the public can go online and view all of the data that was analyzed, and they can view the fact sheets and the decisions. They can basically see everything of our thought process for how we came up with a listing or delisting determination. Additionally, the database generates fact sheets where each water body pollutant pair can be, the overview of each water body pollutant pair can be seen online. The assessment process utilized to develop the 2008 303D list is as follows. First, staff began by gathering data. The Regional Water Board staff solicited, assembled, and considered all readily available data and information, including data submitted during the data solicitation period, swamp data, and numerous other forms of data that are listed on this slide. Second, staff analyzed the data according to the rules of the listing policy. Third, staff developed what is termed a line of evidence in the California Water Quality Assessment Database for each data submittal, and I'll be discussing explaining lines of evidence a little bit more in the next slide. Finally, staff proposed a decision based on the data and information that was analyzed. So here's an example of a line of evidence, and this one is for Pudding Creek for indicator bacteria. The lines of evidence, they all look almost exactly the same except for the content, but the format is the same. They all list the pollutant as well as the beneficial use that is most affected by that pollutant. The LOE lists the number of samples that were available for analysis as well as the number of samples that exceeded the objective or evaluation guideline. The water quality objective that was used for the data to be compared to is listed. And in the event that that water quality objective is narrative, an evaluation guideline, a numeric evaluation guideline, was used to interpret the narrative water quality objective, and the data were compared to the evaluation guideline. A brief description of the data that was used to make this determination is given here, as well as information on the spatial and temporal representation of the data and the quality assurance information for the data. I also want to point out that each of these underlined sections is either a reference or a hot link to the actual data that was used in this analysis. So like I said, it's a very transparent process where someone can go online, see this, click on those links, and get the details of everything that we used in our assessment. So following data assessment and the development of all lines of evidence for each water body pollutant pair, staff determined whether the data reflected attainment of water quality standards or not, meaning whether the water body was impaired or unimpaired. And we made a recommendation through a listing or delisting decision. These decisions are staff's recommendation to the board about whether to list, delist, or make no change to a particular water body pollutant pair. So here's an example of a decision for Pudding Creek for indicator bacteria. And these decisions all, again, have the same format, and they include the water body name, the pollutant that is in question that we're looking at. The final listing decision is listed on here, and in this case, it's to list on the 303D list. The weight of evidence is described, and the weight of evidence includes all the lines of evidence and additional quantitative information that we used to make this decision. So this is like a summary of our findings. And we give the Regional Water Board's recommendation for the water body. There's also room when this process goes to the State Board and the EPA for them to put in their decisions. So how did we make our decisions, and how did we determine whether something was impaired or unimpaired? We looked at the data found in the lines of evidence and applied the rules of the listing policy. In many instances, we looked at the number of times that a sample exceeded the water quality objective or evaluation guideline, and we looked at the number of samples taken. And we used an exceedance frequency from the listing policy, and by this I mean there are tables and equations in the listing policy that give us the allowable number of exceedances of the objective or evaluation guideline that are allowed depending on a sample size. And basically, if you go above that number of exceedances, it recommends and says you must list the water body. If you're below it, you don't have to list. And so in some cases, we used an exceedance frequency. In other cases, we used a weight of evidence approach to show that the water body was simply not attaining water quality standards. In all cases, a fact sheet for each water body pollutant pair includes the evidence used to support our decision or our recommendation, and it also includes the specific section of the listing policy we use to make that recommendation. So we're very clear about whether we're using exceedance frequency or weight of evidence section of the listing policy. Before Matt goes into the details of staff's recommendations, I just want to identify the next steps in this process. The first step is the hearing that is going on today, where we're going to ask the board to approve the current 303D list that we're proposing. The next step is that the State Water Board will hold a hearing to hear the modifications that each board has made to the 303D list. And at this point, the State Water Board has the authority to accept, reject, or modify any listings that are proposed to them by the regional boards. Finally, the State Water Board compiles all of the state's recommendations into the the California 303 D-list and sends it to the US EPA for approval. And again, at that level, the US EPA has the opportunity and the authority to reject, accept, or modify any listings proposed by the state. So there's basically, that's just to let you know, there's a three-step process before this list is final. And finally, that brings us to staff's recommendations. We made about 550 specific water body pollutant pair assessments. And of that, staff are recommending that 5 water body pollutant pairs be delisted from the 303D list and recommending that 17 new pairs be added to the 303D list. So here is a summary of the recommendation decisions. Before I get into the recommendations for listing and delisting, this is a summary of all the changes to our recommendations since the public review draft. So for the Klamath River sediment, initially we were proposing to list. And as you can see, we're still proposing to list, although the geographic extent of those listings have changed. For Woolly Creek temperature, originally the public review draft proposed delisting, and at this time we're proposing do not delist. For the Mad River and Russian River, for DDE and DDT, we're initially said to we were recommending to list, and now we are recommending do not list. And then there are 5 aluminum pollutant listings that initially, when those data were analyzed, we recommended do not list, and at this time now we are recommending to be listing those 5 water bodies for aluminum. So this table gives an overview of the 5 proposed delistings. It shows the hydrologic unit where the water body is located, the water body name, and the pollutant that we are proposing it be delisted for. So again, staff are recommending that these water body pollutant pairs be delisted because the new data and evidence shows that they are attaining water meeting water quality standards. The following 2 tables are staff's recommendations for listings. There are 17 in all, and again, similar to the other table, they show the hydrologic unit, the water body name, and the pollutant. This table is for the shows the Klamath River and Mendocino Coast-related water body listings recommended. And here are those we recommend for the Russian River and the Eel River. I'll now turn things over to Matt St. John.
So before we dive into each of the listing and delisting recommendations, I wanted to make it clear that we have prepared slides for each new listing or delisting recommendation. And at the board's pleasure, we can go over every single one. If we were to do that, just to give a context in terms of time, it would probably take us to about quarter or 20 past 3. So what I'm going to propose is that I would like to present a couple of the listings that reflect changes from our public review draft, because those are a little bit more of the tricky ones, as well as we know that there's folks here from the public who are going to comment, and so staff would like to have the opportunity to present the rationale for our recommendations. So when I'm done going through those few, I will then ask the board what your pleasure is of how to proceed from there. So I'm skipping now to slide number 18 on yours, shows 20 on ours. And we're talking about the recommendations associated with Mad River for DDE, the Scott River for DDT, and the Russian River Guerneville hydrologic subarea for DDT. One of the reasons that I wanted to highlight these 3 listings is regional board staff followed the rules of the listing policy very closely for all of our listing recommendations. But these 3 are an exception, where based on the weight of the evidence, we are actually making a recommendation that is slightly different than the listing policy, and I'll walk you through that. After reviewing the data, staff are now making the recommendation not to list the Mad River for DDE and to not list the Scott River for DDT, as well as not listing the Russian River Guerneville hydrologic subarea for DDT. All of this DDT and the cofactors of DDT data was provided by our surface water ambient monitoring program data that was collected from 2002 to 2006. The evaluation guideline that we use for DDE and DDT is from EPA's National Recommended Water Quality Criteria, and it's an extremely low criteria of 0.00022 micrograms per liter. This is the evaluation guideline that we have used, and it is a guideline that was established by EPA to protect human health from the consumption of water or organisms that contain DDT. The criteria are so low that the reporting limits and the method detection limits for DDE and DDT from samples that were collected by the SWAMP program are actually higher. So as shown here, the reporting limit for DDE is 0.002, and for DDT is 0.005. Let me define the reporting limit. It's the lowest concentration at which the parameter DDT or DDT can be detected in a sample, and its concentration can be reported with a reasonable degree of accuracy and precision. In addition, as I mentioned, there are what's called method detection limits, and these are levels that are lower than the reporting limit. And the method detection limits are estimates. It's not an actual, an assured measurement. And it's an estimate of the measured concentration at which there's a 99% confidence that the parameter DDT or DDE is present in a given sample. So if you have a level of DDE or DDT that's below the reporting limit, but it's above the method detection limit, the lab reports it as detect, not quantifiable. And then an estimated value is assigned to it, and it's some value that's between the concentration of the method detection limit and the reporting limit. So for the Mad River, there was one sample that had a detection of 0.004 micrograms per liter, and then one sample that was detect, not quantifiable. Similarly, for the Scott River, there were two samples that were detect, not quantifiable, and they were given an estimated concentration of 0.0027 and 0.003. So per the listing policy, there are sufficient violations of these evaluation guidelines to warrant putting these water bodies, the Scott and the Mad River, on the 303D list for DDT and DDE. However, there's some other information about the listing policy that we think is incredibly relevant to this. And the listing policy says that when there is a sample that is less than the quantitation limit or the quantification limit, and when that quantitation limit is greater than the evaluation guideline, then the listing policy says you shouldn't use that result in your assessment. So in other words, if we have a sample size of 20 total samples, but 18 of them were non-detect, because the non-detects have are below the evaluation guideline, or I'm sorry, above the evaluation guideline, but below the method detection limit, the listing policy says we can't consider those. So then we have to consider just having two hits, two, and the sample size is two hits out of two samples. So what this presents is a situation in which if these water bodies are put on the 303D list, they essentially can't be taken off, given the current this current policy and the current evaluation method detection limits. Even if they were more samples were collected and they came back as non-detect, per the listing policy, you can't consider those data. So a couple more things is that all of the detections in the Scott and the Mad River were from samples collected in 2002 and 2003. All of the subsequent detections or all the subsequent samples for those water bodies have been non-detect. And there have been no DDE or DDT detections in any watersheds in the North Coast since 2003. So we had some hits, samples that exceeded this evaluation guideline in 2002 and 2003 in the MAD and the SCOT. Since then, there have been no hits anywhere else in the region. So our staff is making the recommendation not to list at this time and to collect additional data through our swamp program, which is already planned as part of our plan, and to hold off making a recommendation at this time. So that's our recommendation.
I want to add just one thing. The detections in the Scott and the MAD in 2002 and 2003, there were actually detections throughout the North Coast region from swamp samley in 2002 and 2003. They were not frequent. There were not enough of them to warrant listings in those water bodies, but there were many water bodies in 2002 and 2003 that had detections, and none of them have had detections since then. And that kind of just adds to the weight of why we're wondering everywhere we saw it in 2002 and 2003 and now nowhere we're seeing it. So it just raised question in our mind.
And thanks for clarifying that, because Russian River was one in which there were hits in two of the different hydrologic sub-areas in 2002 for the Russian River. And in the public review draft, frankly, we had pooled those inappropriately. And then when we realized these are in separate hydrologic sub-areas, that's why we're now saying not to list for the Russian River. So unless there's questions on this, I'm going to move on to Woolly Creek temperature. So I am now going back to slide number 18. Woolly Creek is a tributary to the Salmon River. Salmon River is a tributary to the Klamath River. The North Coast, our board staff, completed a temperature TMDL, which was adopted by the regional board in June of 2005. And this was a TMDL addressing temperature for the Salmon River watershed. Subsequently, this TMDL was approved by EPA in March of the following year, 2006. For context, the temperature, the narrative temperature objective in our basin plan, which is what we develop a TMDL to meet a temperature objective, the temperature objective is that natural receiving water temperatures shall not be altered, and that at no time or place should any cold water, a water that supports cold water species, be increased more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit above that natural receiving water temperature. So we developed a temperature TMDL for the Salmon River watershed, and needless to say, quantification of natural receiving water temperatures is a big effort. And in the TMDL, we set load allocations for the Salmon River watershed, including Woolly Creek, of what we call adjusted potential effective shade. And what we were saying there is if you meet site potential effective shade conditions, then you are meeting natural receiving water temperatures. So the allocation was to site potential or effective potential shade conditions. Thank you. Catherine's reminding me to mention here that temperatures in any given watershed can be above evaluation guidelines that we use that are based on biological salmonid temperature requirements and still be considered natural. We use evaluation guidelines of salmonid temperature requirements as a screening level to assess the temperature conditions of a water body. But it is wholly possible, and there are certainly watersheds in the North Coast, that have temperatures that exceed those evaluation guidelines and, based on our analysis, are meeting natural receiving water temperatures. And it is in the TMDL where we identified that riparian shade is essentially the surrogate that we were using to evaluate whether natural receiving water temperatures are being met. During the for the public review draft of the 303 D-list update, we regional board staff recommended that Woolly Creek be delisted for temperature. And this was in response to information that was submitted to us and a specific request to consider delisting of Woolly Creek. So we made a consideration, and we originally in our public review draft recommended that that Woolly Creek be delisted for temperature. However, during our public comment period, there were public comments that were submitted, as well as input that we received by State Water Resources Control Board staff, which caused us to step back and take a second look at our delisting recommendation and to reevaluate the approach that we had taken to assess whether temperature conditions in Woolly Creek are impaired or not. So in the public review draft, our recommendation to delist had been based on a determination that there was less than 15% of human disturbance in the Woolly Creek watershed. And so we concluded in the public review draft that there was less than 15% human disturbance, and therefore the stream temperatures reported in Woolly Creek were natural and meeting our basin plan's temperature objective. Based on some input that we got, again, from the public as well as comments from State Board staff, we determined that we needed to, that it was inappropriate to use the human disturbance as the indicator of whether natural receiving water temperatures were met, and that the TMDL that we had developed was the appropriate tool or metric to use, in this case, looking at riparian shade. So we determined that the appropriate evidence required for making a delisting recommendation was to look at whether there has been alteration of shade from human activities. And so we can do this by monitoring of riparian shade conditions and looking at whether the TMDL estimates of adjusted potential effective shade is being met, or whether the current effective shade conditions in Woolly Creek watershed have been altered or not. If it can be determined that they haven't been altered, then it can be determined that they're meeting their effective shade conditions and that they therefore are natural. So the listing policy requires us to make a determination based on data and information, and that we must have data and information in order to make a conclusion. And so based on what the information that we have in front of us, we feel like we don't have that information on shade conditions in the Woolly Creek watershed that we would need in order to make the true assessment of whether or not Woolly Creek is meeting natural receiving water temperatures. Believe me, we would like to have all of our watersheds delisted. And you'll hear from comments and from the public that, come on now, Woolly Creek is a wilderness area. How can it not be, how can it be considered to be impaired? And that's a good question. It's a valid question. We need to be true to the listing policy, which says that we need to make determinations based on data and information that we have at hand. And what we're saying is that the data and information that we need to have at hand to make that determination is data and information on shade conditions and whether those shade conditions have been altered by human activities. We currently don't have that information, so we're recommending additional monitoring of riparian shade conditions in Woolly Creek and to then take another look at it in the next listing cycle. The final thing I want to bring to your attention is that staff are currently have an MOU with both Six Rivers and Klamath National Forest. And this was an action that came out of the development of the TMDL. It really was the implementation plan, was the development of an MOU with the Forest Service. And this MOU is being circulated right now for signature by these agencies. And the Salmon River MOU commits the parties to develop a temperature and shade monitoring program that we believe could and should be the mechanism for developing the appropriate information that we're saying is needed in order to make the final determination of whether delisting is warranted or not. So that concludes the presentation on Woolly Creek. And at this point, I look to you for input. We could now plow ahead and move into our other overview of the other handful of listing and delisting recommendations. We could focus simply on ones that you have interest in, or we could take your questions or take public comment. It's your decision.
I think the way to approach it then is your latter alternative. Board members have questions. We can pose them now. We'll take public comment, and then we'll come back to have additional review by the board. Pick up more detail on the listing recommendations at that point if we feel compelled or not. We have questions? Mr. Corbett.
Yes, first on the delistings, did we do anything or do we just have better information on the delistings listed on page 22?
When you say,
did we have any regulatory effect that it created the need to delist them, or just upon further data review, we decided we basically probably should have never listed them in the first place?
It's a great question. As far as, and I'll just take them one at a time. With respect to the two ocean beaches within the Bodega HU, this is based on new data that was collected by the Sonoma County Department of Health Services. And based on this new data, you know, the total sample size, the number of exceedances of the ocean plan bacteria standards, per the listing policy, there's not enough hits. It should be delisted. In the case of the Eel River watershed sediment and siltation delistings, so this is the, you know, for Middle Fork Eel and the North Fork Eel. These are watersheds that have sediment siltation TMDLs that were developed by US EPA. And we have determined that the sediment load allocations for these reaches are currently being met. And so they're being met. They're at natural background levels. They should be delisted. So that is a little bit of a different case. There was a regulatory action that has happened. We took a look at it, and we realized that delisting was appropriate. And then Pocket Canyon Creek for pH is similar in category to the bacteria listings, where there's just more data that's now available that indicates that it's not impaired for pH.
Okay. Then, first of all, I want to compliment people from when I first came on the board, the 303 delisting and the information and the value I presented to the board gets better every time. And I certainly think you very professionally applied the watershed segment analysis criteria. But I have a little question about how we're going to fit this into a coherent end product. And the question is this. We're using the basin plan for amendment, which generally is theoretically a watershed unit. And TMDLs were actually a tremendous boost because when the Port of Colonel Act was passed, we did the very gross basin plan. And then even though it's clear the legislature, Clean Water Act, everyone wanted very intense water quality planning, it sort of went away, wasn't funded. TMDL brought it back. But my worst nightmare would be to have a basin plan that's balkanized by, oh, this segment has this rule, that segment has that rule, this is delisted, this is listed. And so I think a lot of care needs to be taken that the process vehicle we are using is the basin plan, and that if we go to a watershed that we make sure we have a coherent regulatory process. There is one easy way to do that, and that is you can apply some of the implementation criteria for the impaired segments to the rest of the watershed. And so then at least a person doesn't have to go, oh, I stepped off my ranch or I bought my neighbor's property and I have different rules. And that's certainly an approach, but I do want staff to start thinking how we don't have a bunch of balkanized segments, but that we have a watershed plan that's coherent and coordinated when we're done. And I realize you're strictly following the process. I appreciate that. But I did want to tell you, I want to have a public document that the public and myself can understand. And that will, I think, require, since we're using a basin plan mechanism, a view of how we tie the segments together, sort of a coordinating approach so that there's a coherent set of regulations for people. Just a comment.
Okay. Mr. Hale.
Thanks. Thanks, Matt. In the table you have on slide 14, the changes from the public review draft, we have basically three choices that are shown here. We either are adding something new to the list, we have something that's already on the list and we're deciding to keep it on, or we are removing something from the list. The only one that fits keep on the list is Woolly Creek. How many others do we have that just, this is just changes to the public review draft. How many others are we keeping on the list that are we're recommending keeping on?
Well, it's a bunch.
Okay.
And it's in the staff report.
Yeah.
Table 10 is the table that identifies, table 9, which starts on page 24, mm-hmm. which is the whole 2008 303D list. So we did assessments for, as Catherine said, 550
right.
toxic water body fluid impairs. And so, for instance, we're not going over right now, to throw one example out, Navarro River for temperature. We're not presenting that. But we are also keeping it on the 303D list.
Yeah. The way I phrased that question led to a much larger population of listings that I wanted to get to. Where I'm going with this is that looking at Woolly Creek, and I'm wondering if there's others that fit into a similar type of example where there's a consideration to delist it, but we don't have enough information yet to actually delist it. Woolly Creek's getting some special consideration here, and we're going forward with a monitoring approach, and we've got an MOU with the Forest Service so we can collect some more information and learn more about that might warrant delisting it. Are there others out there that aren't receiving this consideration that should, or is that just an insurmountable number, or do you have any insight on that? Just
well, I mean, my when we do an update to a 303D list, it's our opportunity to look at all of them. There is a reality that we are limited in how much we can do. And so we tend to be responsive to those water body pollutant pairs for which there is information specific, submitted to us to take a close look at.
Got it.
And so in this case, Woolly Creek is one of those that the public, said, take a look at this, and we have. But if you go onto our website and you can click on these lines of evidence and decisions for all of the water bodies that then show up in the tables that are summarized in the staff report. We're just not going over each one here because it didn't lead to a change in recommendation.
And I'll just add that online you can see, when you look at those lines of evidence, you can see in our decisions, you can see whether we said we don't have enough data to make a determination or the data we have shows it's still impaired, keep it on. So that's when, someone who's interested in that water body can go see, well, they didn't have enough data.
Sure.
I'm going to do something. I'm going to call them and see what I can do.
And our response is largely based on a stakeholder feedback for that's how we're responding to Woolly Creek
because
here.
Because there's so much to cover. That's pretty much how
sure.
we have
No, that's great. Thanks for answering my question.
Mr. Chair, can I ask for an example, too? In the listing, the new listing, Matt, indicator bacteria shows up several times here. And when I look at the line of evidence, for instance, for Green Valley Creek watershed, indicator bacteria exceeds. But yet this data, it looks like it's a relatively small window of time frame, 2002, 2003, first flush sampling. We've got data that's 7 years old, and yet we go to delisting on things that we have better data on that's newer and maybe more representative. A couple questions. Does data become so dated that it falls out of our criteria list for looking at something? Because indicator bacteria to me is a big one, having gone through and sat through the 885 process, which is a very uncertain process at this point, and yet what is that? How do we take data and reckon data that's from 2002, 2003, and we get to today and we're listing it in these hydrologic units? And that's just a – go ahead.
The listing policy lays out that you have to use all readily available data. And in the case of this is the latest and greatest information that we have, and it's what we have to make a determination using. It is within – our power to say we won't use data from 1975 because it's very old, but in terms of using what we could term recent, we haven't been excluding data from 2000 and before. And should we discuss the 885 slide? We have one of those.
I'm not sure which part you were thinking to show, but with regard to parameters that present a public health risk, it is true that we, when the data is available, we rely more closely on the more recent data. Because things like a parameter like indicator bacteria, as we know, that can change through time.
Well, and it's a bit loaded at this point, too. I mean, from a standpoint, say the Lower Russian. The Lower Russian is an area that has a lot of contact recreation. It has established riparian development. It has towns and people, and it has some actually undisturbed areas down there, too. But to list this thing for indicator bacteria on data that's maybe 6 to 7 years old, do we have anything newer in the mix here? Because it looks like to me that all this data, at least for this particular listing, is a bit old. And do we go out and verify that listing? Do we go out and verify that data through this last season? Because I think one of our next agenda items is all the stormwater sampling that's going out there on in the greater wide world. Do we use that data? Does that data come into this set for the pollutant pair that's particular to this in this listing? Do we have new data? Do we have data that's 2008 stormwater season?
We do. We use the new data. At the same time, we're only using the data. There is a cutoff point at which we don't use more recent data because we use the data that we receive during the public solicitation period, which in the case of this list closed in February of 2007. And the reason for that is Catherine mentioned that here it is, it's 2009 and we're working on the 2008 list. Well, we kind of at some point have to call it good and work with that, make an assessment, lead to a regulatory action, and then take the next steps, and then start the poll process again. But so in the case of some of this indicator bacteria, there is more recent data that's been that's out there. We have not assessed that data from the for this 303D list update.
As a follow-up to that, too, and you might want to take this example instead of just us keep going here, because I think that's what the chair asked. But I would also ask, do we speciate bacteria when we look at bacteria? Do we type that bacteria to Enterococcus or human-derived or animal-derived?
Well, not to human or animal-derived during the listing process.
It's simply mammalian source?
The data that we're looking at is Enterococcus, E. coli, fecal coliform, and total coliform.
And I would add that in using the most recent data, what happens is we recommend, based on the data that we evaluated, that this be placed on the 303D list. Then, when development of a TMDL occurs, we consider all recent data, we collect new data, and we make sure to, as you said, to verify that this listing determination is appropriate for the areas that we considered. And AB 885 is only triggered once a TMDL is actually established, not when we're developing one. And so if we don't find certain areas are needing to be, or are impaired by indicator bacteria, we can remove those segments. So we're not going to make any big decisions until we get through the process of an entire TMDL. This just says, let's put it on the list. We need to take a closer look.
True, and I understand that and appreciate that. At the same time, though, under our listing criteria, the delisting criteria are rather rigorous to get off of that list as well. So once we put it on the list, it's a gift that keeps on giving. And so from that standpoint, I just caution that to put it on a list, it's, and I understand it's done with thought and care, just that the data is robust and supportive of that over a wide time frame that's repeatable, dependable, and I think that from what I've seen, I think staff has gone through and used, I think that from what I, and I don't have a history with the 303D list, it's the first time I've seen it, but that the listing criteria actually is a big help, it sounds like. But once you're on there, it's very hard to get off. And there are implications.
We agree with that.
Well, and there are implications to being on there, because if it's 2009 and we're looking at a 2008 list, then we're going to hit this again at 2011 and looking at 2012, and perhaps we'll be hip deep into a TMDL in the Russian. And that perhaps could have implications at that time. Not to say that it's not right to list it. And that's just an example, but I guess from that standpoint, I would just ask, the data set becomes very important, I think, to look at listing and delisting.
Well, just a comment in response to the implications of a TMDL. If, when we then develop a TMDL, as you know, we're then assessing sources and assigning allocations to those factors or sources that are contributing. If we determine that for a particular area, a specific source or factor isn't contributing, then there's no new controls for that area or for that source or factor. So it's not a pre-gone conclusion that you get on the list and then on the 303D list, and then a TMDL is going to be developed that requires actions that are going to be required. There are places where we have developed, Salmon River, just to use an example, when we initiated the temperature TMDL development, we were also initiating a nutrient TMDL development. And back in 2002, we had done an analysis during TMDL development that led us to believe that the Salmon River is not impaired for nutrients, and we recommended it be delisted, and it was delisted. The same example would go, a similar example would be for the Upper Lost River, where we initiated a TMDL development. We got new data. We determined the Upper Lost River was not temperature or nutrient impaired, and were delisted.
And that's a good point. The source assessment in the TMDL will differentiate between natural and human caused, and that's where we weed it out. We're not necessarily, at this point, at this screening level, we don't know, but that's where the TMDL makes sure that we make the right determination. It looks at that in detail.
Thank you.
Other board member questions? If not, at this point, the chair is going to exercise his chair duties and welcome and announce Heidi Harris, having joined us some time back, and declare we're going to take a recess for 10 minutes. And we've been joined by the State Board Liaison, Tam Dodok. Thank you for coming. And we're going to now take public comment. I have speaker cards. Greg Lowry, Forest Service. Sorry, you want to come? Thank you. Sorry, Summer Stream. And I know you've requested and we'll grant you some extra time.
Okay, I see 3 minutes. Thank you very much. I did have a handout. Did everyone get that handout?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. My name is Sari Sommerstrom, and I'm speaking on the Woolly Creek delisting request. Today I'm speaking about the common sense response for delisting Woolly Creek as impaired for temperature. I'm going to wear two hats today, and I will make it clear which hat I'm wearing at what time. One is for the Siskiyou Resource Conservation District, who could not be here today, and the other one is as a watershed consultant who's worked in this area for over 30 years. And I also was a former Regional Water Board member in 2005, who was a board member when some of you were still there, I think, in 2005, at the time that the Salmon River TMDL was adopted. Siskiyou County and the Forest Service will also be talking about this request after me. The Woolly Creek was delisted, was listed for temperature in 1994 as part of the Salmon River subbasin. I'm arguing with the Siskiyou RCD that this listing was an error for many reasons. Wearing the Siskiyou RCD hat right now, the district sent a letter in February 07 requesting that it be delisted as impaired. The district believed then and still believes that this is a natural watershed with no significant human-induced or controllable sources affecting stream temperature. It's a 95,000-acre watershed. This is a mountainous backcountry. It was designated as a primitive area as part of the Marble Mountain in 1931, since been designated by Congress as a congressional wilderness area. It's very pristine. I guess the exact figure is 96.7% is officially within the wilderness area. The Forest Service is managing this as wilderness. With or without the TMDL, it would be managing this for wilderness. Almost all human uses are prohibited within a wilderness area. However, wildfires and debris slides do occur. I think the bottom line with the RCD's position is, if this untrammeled wilderness cannot be delisted as impaired, then what can in the North Coast region? And the second point they want to make, because of the TMDLs that are in place for many people in areas that definitely have human uses, what kind of signal are you sending to those working hard to meet TMDLs in other watersheds, such as the Scott River, that even a wilderness cannot meet your temperature standard? Okay, now I'm wearing my hat as Sari Sommerstrom, PhD, Natural Resource Consultant. When the Salmon River TMDL was adopted in 2005, I very reluctantly supported it. I think Kat will remember that challenging time. And part of the reason why was because of my discomfort with Lily Creek being having to come under those TMDL protocols. At that time, when I talked to staff before the adoption of that, and many times afterwards, I was assured that, don't worry, we'll reevaluate Willow Creek at the next 303D process, which is what we're in through right now. And then we will then look at that data. And so I feel that, unfortunately, this new process has not come to the correct conclusion with the final recommendation up there. I feel that really the bottom line is the staff is really misconstruing the intent of the Clean Water Act and the Port of Cologne Act for what their definition of natural is. I'm going to quote from the Clean Water Act, which defines pollution as the man-made or man-induced alteration of the chemical, physical, biological, and radiological integrity of water. An impaired water body in the Act is any water body that does not attain water quality standards due to pollutants. The North Coast Basins Plan states that controllable water quality factors are those actions, conditions, or circumstances resulting from man's activities that may influence the quality of the waters of the state, and that may be reasonably controlled. So to me, the main issue with Willie Creek is there are no human causes influencing its water temperature. There is no pollution that is man-induced. There is no impaired water body since there are no human-caused pollutants, and there are no controllable factors, water quality factors that result from man's activities. It should never have been listed. I have 5 points that I would like to make to clarify this. The no significant impact, with 96% designated wilderness, it does have flooding, it does have debris slides, it does have wildfires. This rugged and hot interior is going to be prone to natural disturbances. They cannot be prevented. There's only a few roads within the watershed, and almost all of those have been decommissioned, as the Forest Service will elaborate on. Grazing by cattle is allowed in the wilderness on several allotments, with small portions overlapping the Willow Creek watershed. However, these cows graze in the upper watershed, as this photo here is going to show to you. They're meadows. It's not like a great grassy plain like the Scott River with an alluvial valley. And so they're way up in the watershed, not the riparian areas along the very steep creek. It's extremely steep and rugged. In fact, the statistics show that only 105 cow-calf pairs are allowed to be grazed within this 95,000-acre watershed. The Klamath National Forest, again, will present this information in more detail. Natural grazing by Roosevelt elk, which were reintroduced, are native, also occurs within the wilderness. Number two, there are no reference streams identified in the entire North Coast Basin, which is almost 20,000 square miles, and it's just hard for me to believe that we have yet, after all these years, come up, not identified one single stream or watershed that is considered of sufficient quality to be deemed unimpaired for temperature. The Port of Cologne Act, again, states that regional plans and their water quality objectives must consider several factors, including the environmental characteristics of the hydrographic unit, including the quality of the water available there, too. That means baseline condition, what is natural. The Basin Plan's water quality objective for temperature, as you well know, states that at no time or place shall the temperature of any cold water be increased by more than 5 degrees above natural receiving water. Yet there was no attempt made by staff in the Salmon River TMDL, or any TMDL that I can find, to determine what that natural receiving water is. Instead, analyses are based on models. They're based on an expectation of optimum temperature for cold water fisheries. So if the temperature is higher than 16 degrees, what does that mean? Higher than desirable, but that is what you get in a wilderness natural system. Unfortunately, that means what you see is what you get. You get debris slides, fires, and floods. And that does not mean a definition for impaired. Again, they're not human-caused. It's extremely steep and rocky up there. You're not going to get much riparian established on a lot of that bedrock. So the shade canopy is going to naturally be low. Again, this should be a reference stream because So I've got to rush here. Staff's response to the public comments to me show they really are just trying to go with this TMDL target and are ignoring what is natural. The scale of the Willow Creek hydrologic subarea to me, fits the water quality limited segments. It should be pulled off separately. You have precedent for using that scale of HSA and not just a huge sub-basin. A designation as unimpaired should be seen to me as being proud to have that unimpaired quality. I'm afraid some people feel fearful of that, that somehow bad management is going to be released, or they're not going to have money to do monitoring, or there won't be money to do restoration in Salmon River. So my bottom line is that I think your draft report did correctly identify the watershed as a low amount of human disturbance, and therefore the natural receiving water has not been altered by human activities. And your final report is incorrect. I encourage you to adopt the draft report supporting information, including the line of evidence 21155, and modify the final list as above when you do your resolution today. Please follow the intent of the acts and address human-caused impairments of water quality, which there's plenty to deal with in the North Coast region, and leave these natural unimpaired watersheds unlisted. If this natural wilderness watershed can't be delisted for temperature, what watershed can be considered unimpaired? So, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Questions? All right, Greg Lowry.
My name is Greg Lowry. I'm from Klamath National Forest. The Klamath National Forest has been working with the board staff since the Willow Creek was originally listed over this issue of delisting our listing. Our position has been that there is such minimal impact in Willow Creek drainage that it represents background conditions, that the disturbance is not large enough to impact temperatures or shade, and the shade in the Willow Creek represents the natural condition, the potential condition. And just to give you an idea, put this in perspective, the handout that I handed around, on the map you can see, this is a map of our allotments. The allotment over there on the west side, Cudahy, that allotment is vacant. There's no grazing in that allowed anymore. And we don't expect it to be grazed in the future just because of access is difficult in there. And the other grazing on the top of the drainage there coming over from Shackleford and Little North Fork, those are the center of those grazing allotments are on the Scott Valley side, and they just some cows slop over onto the Woolley side, but it's very light grazing, and the number of cow-calf pairs there is 65 currently for the entire Woolley Creek drainage. So we don't believe that level of grazing has a significant impact, and we did measure this BMP effectiveness monitoring back in 2002, and that analysis found that there's no livestock impact on riparian vegetation. The only other disturbance in this watershed that's man-caused is roads. And the road density right now is less than 0.1. And those are on the map also. You can see we've decommissioned half of the original roads in there. And the location of those roads are mostly on ridgetops. They're not valley bottom roads, so they are not affecting riparian shade except for two perennial stream crossings. And so as a whole, we feel two perennial stream crossings and 65 cow-calf pairs in the watershed, it's not enough to reduce riparian shade. And in fact, we would like to use this watershed as a reference. And there's one other issue. You asked about other streams you know, that may be on the list that we don't have information for. We're in a similar situation across the entire Klamath National Forest. You know, every stream on the forest is listed as impaired. That includes wilderness streams, roadless areas, completely unmanaged watersheds. And they were listed originally based on, you know, this disturbance, 15% disturbance. But there really was no evidence to show an alteration of stream temperatures. But now we're in the position of trying to show that those are not unimpaired, and we have to go collect data. But we're talking about 400 watersheds on the forest covering 1.2 million acres. And it's very difficult. A listing is very impacted on our operation. And I'm out of time, so I could go on, but I won't.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? All right. Mr. Massey.
One question. When you say that that a listing is impactive, how does it distinguish itself for Forest Service as opposed to other entities?
Well, I can't speak for other entities, but when we're listing, that means, you know, there's all the things that follows from that, you know, timber harvest waivers, the regulations from TMDLs, so we have to inventory, all sediment sources in the watershed. We have to do riparian shade analysis, and it limits everything we do. And these are in watersheds that we don't believe are impaired to begin with. And probably the biggest thing is we have to go do monitoring on these. So, you know, we have to be doing in-channel monitoring, you know, sediment deposition, temperature, shade, if we want to show that we're in compliance. And it's just the scale of the problem is enormous.
Mm-hmm. But there's nothing that applies to the Forest Service as a distinct entity that does not apply to others?
I can't speak for others. I don't know what those rules are.
Thank you.
Mr. Hales?
If you were to get Woolly Creek as a reference watershed for you, it sounds like it would actually be pretty useful for you for comparison for these 400 others that you have, that you could use that as a type demonstration to potentially argue for a delisting of those other water bodies.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm working with the water board staff, who are very good to work with, by the way. You have excellent staff. But we're proposing that very thing, to identify a network of reference streams across the entire national forest. And, you know, those would be, you know, as a group, we would define the natural variation we can compare managed streams to.
And
if everything's listed, you know, can you call a reference stream a reference if it's impaired, if it's listed as impaired?
And as of now, you have nothing.
We have nothing. And these are roads with, you know, some watersheds have no roads or very, very low road densities.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Rick Gustalis.
Yeah, my name is Rick Gustalis. I'm the natural resource policy specialist for Siskiyou County. I'd like to really quick compliment staff on their website on with regard to being able to follow the lines of evidence and the ease that and the intuitive nature of it that you can kind of navigate your way through it. It's really informative and like they said, it's very very easy to see. Also, I'd like to pass on from Gary Black compliment to David Leland for working with the Montague Water Conservation District in with regard to stuff over on Shastina and with the Shasta River. There is a problem, however, in the mercury listing, and I think it's, I'm not sure I'm checking on this, but, and I've got to talk with the Health Department of Siskiyou County, but it would have been nice to know a little bit more in advance that there were other studies showing the mercury impairment in Shastina rather than the 2001, because their comments and my comments as well, we were only aware that there was studies from 2001. So we're saying in our comments to the board that, geez, we this old data and very small sample showing this, maybe something is wrong, it shouldn't be listed now. Come to find out, there is added data and are other studies that indicate it. They haven't been QA and QC'd yet, but nonetheless, they're being referenced as another indication of mercury impairment. So mercury is is handy in a certain way because it's measured. It's something we can all agree on that it's there, and it does look like it's there, and there's certainly not anybody that's going to want to argue that it's not when studies show that it is, but we would have liked to have had a little sooner heads up on its existence there, which gets me to the temperature impairment of Willy Creek. You've heard from the scientific part. I'm the policy guy. And from a policy standpoint, when you've got a stream that I doubt there's anybody in this room that doesn't feel the listing was initially a mistake, it's how do we rectify that mistake? It seems to me that it's prudent from a policy standpoint to rectify that mistake as soon as possible. It, from my perspective, it complicates trying to explain to people that you should work on these TMDL issues because they can get better and then we can get off of the list. When they can't, when Willy Creek was even listed in the first place, it's pretty tough to convince people that this is a rational process. I'm sorry, to no disrespect meant, but there's been a mistake made here on this listing. And to have the burden of the Forest Service expend it, representing Siskiyou County, we represent the people, we represent the environment, we represent the Forest Service too, and have public agencies, including yourself, if you end up having to spend money to prove this shouldn't have been listed. It's just a waste of effort and time, money, when there are impairments and there are things that do need to be done. And the idea that 65 pairs of cattle, that sort of impact or the level of roads, I mean, cattle don't get down in the bottom, or if they do, they don't come out because the dinosaurs eat them. I mean, it's that is so wild back in there. It's just absolutely unbelievable. And then you've got to ask that if it is impaired, what can the Forest Service possibly do from a management standpoint to affect that impairment? Absolutely nothing. So we've spent the time, we've spent the money to investigate this, and then our hands are tied because we can't do anything. So this is, we're chasing our tails here with limited budgets, limited staff. From a policy standpoint, we've got to do this. And I would suggest to the board to do anything they possibly can within the confines of the law and the technicalities that need to be pursued in terms of following this thing, that we've got to delist this as soon as possible. It's an obstacle for me and in my public relations efforts, and I think it's an obstacle for you in terms of your staff time. That's certainly an obstacle to the Forest Service. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Daniel Myers.
Good afternoon. I'm Daniel Myers. I'm with the Sierra Club. There's another way to delist, and that's the way I prefer to see it, good implementation plans, well executed, and delisting, that's the good way to do it. I have no problem with the list that we're talking about here today, however. My issues pertain to the TMDL listing that shows TMDL priorities and or does not show TMDL priorities and or the completion dates. Now, that hasn't been a subject that we talked about here. Is that not appropriate to bring up at this point? Or
be appropriate.
That's fine. The Federal Clean Water Act says that the state shall establish a priority ranking for such waters, taking into account the severity of the pollution and the uses to be made of such waters. And in the policy that Matthew referred to on TMD scheduling, they say for water quality limited segments needing a TMDL, the regional board shall develop a completion schedule in compliance with federal law and regulation based upon but not limited to the following criteria. And then it lists nine different items there. Well, those criteria indicate to me that they want you to make a differentiation between the TMDLs that are listed there. They not only want you to indicate a priority, and they want you to indicate a schedule as to when they're going to be completed. That has been lost in the proposed 303D list that we're looking at today. There's no longer any priority listing. In your handout there, there's a single sheet has a blue line on the top. It's the 2002 listing, and it has priorities listed for each watershed, high, low, or medium. It's not a great priority ranking, but at least it was something. We don't have any of that now, even though it's required. The other aspect of this is the proposed completion date shown on the right. This is for the Navarro River, and it was first listed in 1995, and it was scheduled for a TMDL completion in the year 2000. It didn't happen, and when year 2000 came, because it was on a consent decree, EPA did a technical TMDL for it. But two years later, this 303 listing had a completion date for the Navarro River, and it was 2004. So they didn't treat that technical TMDL as completion. They treated the completion of an implementation plan as completion. In other words, what we have in the new 303D list, we have a new definition of completion. It has an asterisk, and it has two sets of numbers, one of which is technical TMDL date. It now says that the Navarro River was completed back in 2000, and in the year before that, it said it was scheduled for completion in 2019. So what we have is we've emasculated this part of the 303 list. We don't understand which are the priorities, and the priorities are determined somewhere, somehow, but the public doesn't get an opportunity to see it because it doesn't happen on this list. And we don't have a schedule, and we're entitled to see that. When we don't have a schedule of these TMDLs, things can happen that, in other words, the work that should be happening is masked. In other words, we don't see. What this doesn't show us is that the TMDLs aren't getting worked on, and the completion, there's notes in the language that says the dates beyond 2011 are, you can't count on them, that they aren't fixed. And so I point that out. I think you should send it back, and they should hear that part of the 303D list. Thank you.
Thank you. Brenda Adelman.
Brenda Adelman, Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. I actually did not make any comments on this because when it first came out, I basically looked at the listings. I was focused on the Laguna at the time and thought, well, this looks pretty good. I can check this one off my list. And needless to say, there have been a few issues going on the last year that have kept me otherwise occupied. But a letter came through today from Bob Rawson expressing concern about the term indicator bacteria. And then I thought, well, that's right. I really didn't think of that. And one of the big concerns in our lower river area, Russian River area, is this whole concern about septic tanks and whether or not they really do pollute the river. And the big concern is that there be appropriate testing done to determine whether or not the bacteria that are being looked for here are the ones that are human-caused versus animal-caused. And I did hear someone mention that when you do the TMDL process that you will be making that differentiation. But in terms of the listing, the term indicator bacteria is very, very vague. And it's like the issue becomes at what point do you differentiate and what are the kinds of human-caused bacteria that would allow you to determine whether the problem is coming from people or from wild animals or pets or whatnot. So that's a critical differentiation. Now, whether I mean, if there were even a footnote about this matter rather than making some big change in the document, it would be very helpful to allude to that difference and how it's going to be addressed in the TMDL process. And that's all I really have to say. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Lyra Cressy.
Hello. My name is Lyra Cressy. I work for the Salmon River Restoration Council. I'm speaking about the Woolly Creek 303D. Our organization has been actively engaged in the development and implementation of the Salmon River TMDL, and we're also the pretty much the primary coordinator of cooperative restoration activities in the Salmon River. We would like to say that we support the staff recommendation not to delist Woolly Creek. We're concerned that delisting Woolly Creek will deprioritize it for getting adequate protection and restoration. It's been stated from other commenters that there's been a mistake in listing Woolly Creek. I'd like to point out that Woolly Creek was not listed. The Salmon River watershed was listed for temperature impairment. Woolly Creek is a tributary to the Salmon River, along with many other tributaries, many of which also are in the wilderness. And it's a key contributor to the flow of the Salmon River. It's an important part of the Salmon River subbasin, and it was not listed separately, and it should not be delisted separately. Woolly Creek is 95% wilderness. That's true. And as wilderness, I think it's been stated that there's no reason why it should be listed for any impairment. Wilderness does not imply that there's never been human disturbance. In fact, there has been human disturbance in Woolly Creek. Woolly Creek has been intensively managed throughout its history. Much more than 15% of the watershed has been impacted by human disturbance. The primary impact has been probably over 100 years of fire suppression and fire management. More than 80% of the Woolly Creek watershed has burned since fire suppression activity started, and the vast majority of that 80% has burned in the past 3 years. Active fire suppression is well documented to increase the risk, both the risk of fire and the severity of fire. Woolly Creek has lost much of its riparian vegetation due to fire in the recent three or four year fire seasons. And due to the history of fire suppression, fire in Woolly Creek is an unnatural condition. In addition to fire management, there is and has been extensive livestock grazing in Woolly Creek. Right now, 11% of Woolly Creek is held in grazing allotments. But in the past, there's been extensive grazing by both sheep and cattle in Woolly Creek. And I think that grazing is also well documented to have negative impacts on riparian conditions, including shade and temperature. Although it's been stated that the grazing doesn't have an impact in Woolly Creek, I've seen little data to support that, and we do have accounts from local wilderness users stating that during first flush events on Woolly Creek, there's a relatively significant runoff of both sediment and nutrients due to grazing. We would like to argue that based on the fact that more than 15% of the watershed has been impacted by human disturbance, that the natural receiving water temperature has been altered, and that the MWAT values for the data that's available show that it's well above the recommended 16 degrees Celsius for healthy salmonids. And in addition, as Matt St. John pointed out, the Salmon River TMDL establishes targets for effective shade. to address the temperature impairment in the Salmon River watershed, and there's no data available currently that shows what the effect of shade in Woolly Creek is. Therefore, until that data has been collected, we don't feel comfortable delisting the watershed. I'd also like to point out that Woolly Creek, you might think there's a lot of to-do over a wilderness watershed in the middle of nowhere that is, yes, relatively pristine and unimpaired, but it's a very important watershed. The Salmon River has the last wild run of spring Chinook salmon in the Klamath Basin, and research, including research by Peter Moyle, has indicated that Woolly Creek has some of the best and primary habitat for spring Chinook in the Salmon River. However, somewhat mysteriously, it does not have healthy salmon runs. So until there's been adequate monitoring, assessment, and an attempt to figure out what the relationship between water temperatures, management, and fish populations are, we think that it's inappropriate to delist this watershed.
Okay, thank you. Susan Quorum.
Good afternoon, Chair and Board. Thanks for the time. I'm Susan Quorum, Water Quality Coordinator for the Creek Tribe, and I'm commenting on the 303D listing. I'd like to say we're very happy and supportive that microcystone is being listed on the Klamath River. You know, we've been working on that issue for years, so I'm glad that your staff integrated that into this year's listing. Thank you very much. We'll help lead to get protective more of public health in the future. I think there are some tributaries that are lacking from the sediment listing, but I think I'll probably just work with staff on that and possibly for the next listing on that one. One of the main comments that's been going around today is Woolly Creek watershed. Working for a tribe, we don't like to look just at riparian shading, just at like one little part of the creek. It's very into doing whole watershed management. I think it's so narrow to just focus on one little part of the watershed. You can say, yeah, the cows are way up high where they're not doing anything. Well, the cows also don't know where the lines for the grazing allotment are. They don't see those imaginary boundaries, so they can be moving into the watershed. So they don't know that part of it. So you have to look at the whole entire watershed. You have to look at impacts that have happened from logging, impacts that have happened from roads. Even if they're up on the ridge tops, they're still within the watershed. We need to be managing this watershed entirely, not just for riparian shade. Let's see, what else do we have? One of the main things that we've had that we already talked about was that there have been poor fire management practices in Woolly Creek watershed. As she already said, there's been fire suppression for decades in that watershed. Along with that, there's also been lack of traditional management. Before settlement by white people, there used to be active management by tribal members to remove fuels when there was fires that went through, so that you didn't have these big catastrophic fires. There was also more frequency of fire, so you didn't have these big catastrophic fires. I think you guys are all aware of those issues. For example, we had 2008, a very important part of the watershed burned, Medicine Mountain. It's very important for medicine men. It's important for tribal members. They use it in part of their ceremonies. They use it for gathering subsistence materials, for gathering ceremonial materials, gathering medicinal plants. And because of the fire suppression and the lack of good fire management in that watershed, the whole area is now pretty much a moonscape. So the pine trees they used to have to go gather materials off of are not there anymore. It's going to take decades to replace those stands of trees. So to say that this is an unmanaged watershed is not correct. So we think for right now, until there's more data available, you need to leave it on the list for temperature impairment. That's it. Oh, I still have a little bit more time. I also want to address the issue of there's no reference stream in the North Coast region, which is incorrect, because actually there is one that's called Elder Creek, which is a tributary to the Eel. True, it's not a tributary to the Klamath River, but I get very nervous when people use the word pristine. When you go through all the things of grazing and logging and roads and catastrophic fires, that watershed does not fit into the definition of pristine anymore. Relatively pristine, potentially, but not pristine. So if there is a reference stream available, I'd be very cautious in trying to just pull out watersheds so that you can have a reference stream and naming them reference streams. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you. Scott Harding.
Hello, I'm Scott Harding. I'm here representing Klamath Riverkeeper. Do I need to push the button to start this?
You're all right.
Okay. Great. I want to say that Klamath Riverkeeper supports the staff recommendations as they pertain to the Klamath River Hydrologic Unit in their current report. We support everything that they have in there. I'd like to speak of a couple things in particular. I agree with Susan Corum that there are some additional reaches that need to be addressed for sediment. I think that some data collection is real key to that. So, you know, we have another listing cycle coming up just next year in 2010. Hopefully we can address some of that with some harder numbers at that point. As far as Lake Chastina and Mercury, yes, the data there maybe isn't as new as we would like, but we all know well that mercury is not a pollutant that attenuates through time. If it was there several years ago, it's likely to be there now. In fact, further investigation is probably just going to reveal more sample points that show mercury contamination. So we do support that listing. And as you all know, Klamath Riverkeeper has been very interested and involved in the microcystin issue on the Klamath River, and we're very pleased to see the recommendation that the river be listed down to the Trinity River for its microcystin pollution, and I'm happy to see that we're not going to have a microcystin omission as we did in 2006. As far as Woolly Creek, this one seems to be coming up a lot today. The Salmon River watershed is one of our more intact watersheds throughout the entire state. Here we have a 751 square mile watershed, 98.2% public ownership. That's very unique. 45% wilderness, another 25% in late successional reserve designations under Northwest Forest Plan. This watershed needs to be managed as an intact unit. And we start talking about taking watersheds and splitting them apart to smaller and smaller units and wondering, you know, where's this imaginary line? You know, across the line, something different here versus there. There's no reason to not manage this in an intact manner, especially given the fact that it's nearly all public land. It's not inconveniencing private individuals to any degree to manage as an intact watershed. So how does stream temperature work? Well, you go to the mouth of the river, and you put a thermometer in there, and you get a temperature reading, right? Well, that temperature reading is the sum of all the different parts of everything upstream to that point. In any watershed, no matter how impaired by temperature it may be, sure, you can go to a point and find, hey, here's where things seem to be A-OK. Here's a cold spot. Let's delist it. Right? That's not a very functional and effective way to manage a watershed, and that's kind of what we're being asked to do here with Woolly Creek. We're looking at one of the more functional aspects or the more functional components of the Salmon River watershed and saying, hey, let's call the fact that it doesn't have extensive amounts of human disturbance, as that's relatively narrowly defined, and let's delist it on the basis of that. Fortunately, your staff have realized that saying some arbitrary number of 15% human disturbance therefore equals natural temperature is not a correct criteria for evaluation. And what we need to do is look at the shading, riparian shading, and it's been pointed out really well how riparian shading has been affected in the wilderness. I would say that the increase in catastrophic wildfire due to fuel loading from 98 years of fire suppression would be key to that. Right there. So we do have impacts, and it's not really well understood. The objection of the U.S. Forest Service that they don't want to do monitoring in Woolly Creek watershed is actually totally counter to what needs to be done and counter to your staff's recommendation that we need some more information here. A little disheartened to see that thrown up as an obstacle right here. So we, in fact, need more information rather than less or status quo before we can consider delisting. Thank you.
Scott, if I can ask, in terms of comment you make, 98 years of fire suppression. What's changed in the 99th year then?
I was saying 98 years because the fire suppression really began in earnest in 1911. So nothing's changed in the 99th year. We're going on our 99th year right now. So we have a 98-year buildup of fuel load in the forest, and if you look at the severity of wildfire in the Salmon River, the severity is in an upward trend over time. Did I answer your question?
I'm just trying to square concerns that we're seeing fires that are catastrophic in a period then of fire suppression.
Okay, so fire suppression is not 100% successful. We also are seeing differences in the management techniques these days versus in the past, especially in wilderness areas. So this would really specifically cover Woolly Creek. U.S. Forest Service, BLM, other land management agencies are taking a little bit more of a hands-off approach on wildland fire that is not threatening a wildland-urban interface or population centers, structures, human development. Therefore, recent fires in Woolly Creek have, and I would say appropriately, been held under a kind of hands-off approach by the U.S. Forest Service. But what we see is that we have 98 years of fuel loading of lots of vegetation that's grown up because there's not been the periodic burning. There's not been any sort of traditional fire management such as Native American tribes once did. So we have this extensive fuel buildup. So now when we say, okay, we're going to kind of take a little bit of a hands-off approach and let this fire do its natural thing, it's doing it actually in an unnatural way that's much more severe. Somewhere down the road, after we reduce all the fuels through these fires, we'll end up back in a more natural system. But that's not where we are right now.
All right. Thank you. Don McInhill. And Don is the last card I have. Last call.
Good afternoon. Don McInhill with Russian Riverkeeper. I'm going to give a couple comments. Tom Lyons from California Coastkeeper Alliance could not make the meeting, so I'm going to deliver his comments for him. California Coastkeeper Alliance commends the regional board's staff proposed new additions to the list, specifically the Klamath River, Scott to Trinity River for toxic algae and sediment, the Klamath from Iron Gate to Scott River for toxic algae and sediment, Lake Shastina for mercury, Laguna de Santa Rosa for indicator bacteria, and Green Valley Creek for indicator bacteria and dissolved oxygen. The Coastkeeper Alliance commends the regional board staff reconsideration of their original proposal to delist Woolly Creek for temperature impairment. Woolly Creek is a major tributary of the Salmon River, which is in turn a tributary to the Klamath. The Salmon River Restoration Council, as you just heard, commonly observed dangerously high water temperatures in Woolly Creek exceeding 72 degrees. Given the severe temperature impairment of the already 303 delisted Salmon River, Coastkeeper Alliance finds it imprudent for the ignore the temperature impairment of Woolly Creek, which contributes to the severity of the temperature impairment in the Salmon River. Coastkeeper, California Coastkeeper Alliance also strongly urges the regional board to heed the board staff's revised proposal to keep Woolly Creek listed as temperature impaired. Coastkeeper Alliance strongly urges the regional board and staff to work with the state board to swiftly adopt aggressive TMDL cleanup plans for new and existing water quality limited segments in order to restore beneficial uses. Quick switch of the hat, and I'm speaking on behalf of Russian Riverkeeper. We strongly support and appreciate the board staff's work on the Laguna de Santa Rosa listing for indicator bacteria and Green Valley Creek for indicator bacteria and dissolved oxygen. And briefly, as the previous speaker, Daniel Myers, spoke to, we're concerned about some of the TMDL implementation schedules, specifically for Upper Marquess Creek watershed. It has been on the 303D list for sediment and temperature since 2002. It is currently scheduled for a TMDL in 2019. This used to be a coho refuge. It is no longer, given the impairments. There are very few steelhead making it up, and a delay till 2019 would be potentially waiting until after the fish are gone. Over the years, the Upper Marquess watershed has been repeatedly recognized as an area with exceptional natural resources where the opportunities for conservation are abundant and valuable. And this has also been designated as a priority conservation by the San Francisco Bay Area Joint Agencies Coalition. We urge you to reconsider the schedule for TMDL completion for the Upper Marquess watershed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Don. Don, a question, if I can, in terms of earlier speaker said advised that we should hold up until we were able to prioritize. Would you say hold up action on the listing until we come back with a priority?
No, I think the listing process needs to move forward. We've seen when I first started working on TMDL lists, we seemed to be about 3-4 years behind. We're closer to being current, and I think staying on the listing process is important. I definitely agree with Speaker Myers in that having a public process for consideration of prioritization of TMDLs would be, I think, a very good exercise for this board and certainly something we would support. But as far as pulling everything back, I don't think that's appropriate, personally.
All right. Okay, thank you. Again, that was the last speaker card for this item. I don't know if we're going to bring staff back to respond. Mr. Massey has a question. I'll entertain that.
It is, as much as a question, it's a question for Ms. Coleman. Could you give us a brief, if you will, description of the world that we have with the TMDL requirements and the resources with which we don't have to deal with the problem?
Where to begin? At this point in time, most of our TMDL program is funded with general funds. Most of that resource right now is dedicated to completing the Klamath. We have also already begun work and are spending some time and effort on the Laguna de Santa Rosa and the mercury issues for Pillsbury and Lake Sonoma. That's what we can get to with what we have right now. I think we can anticipate we're going to have fewer staff resources since these are general fund positions. I think we can look to either seeing those, you know, the draconian option is that we will lose all general fund positions and we will not have a TMDL program at all. In fact, that's what the legislative
LAO
recommended, is that the TMDL program should be paid for by the dischargers and therefore done by US EPA and the state should step aside. So that's the draconian option. It is being considered right now. The other option is that we are going to see some cuts and we are going to hopefully be able to bring the Klamath to adopt for you for adoption. Anticipated for October of this year. I think the question of beyond what we've already bitten off of the Laguna de Santa Rosa, which this board directed us to get to in the context of the permit for Santa Rosa, how much more we're going to be able to do beyond that, I think we're going to need to wait and see what we get and what kind of cuts we sustain in the upcoming state year.
And I guess just so that I realize we're preaching to the choir in some sense, but that we remind ourselves that the way we are funded as an entity is specific and programmatic. So we cannot simply take funds off of some other, what we might consider less prioritized item. We cannot do that. Those funds are left intact no matter, so we really can't shift them around. And it is one that as a TMDL, as a board member, I've been very unhappy about, but I also understand that we are dealing with legislative directives and you can't just shift money. Thank you.
Mr. Corbett.
Well, I think it would be good, though, for staff to outline the procedures we do have for prioritization. And I believe one of them is the triennial review, and we did go through a public process of prioritizing the TMDLs. I do want to say, though, I think Mr. Myers has hit on a huge weakness in our process, that we seem better at designating, not so good at undesignating, and extremely low productivity on solving the TMDL process. I think when we get through getting the word from the state legislature and the state board as to what our budget is, we may want to have a study session on what is the best way to attempt to prioritize the TMDL process, what are our options, and they may not be what we want, they may be bleak, but I think we have a duty to try and find a way to make it work with what we have. And I think right now, let's just, we set our priorities in public. Let's continue as we are. But I think we really will need to grapple with this as a board. And we can be happy or unhappy with what's coming down the pike. But we still have to deal with where we are. And I do think the public and does have a right to have us set priorities and struggle in a public session on how the best way we can approach these problems.
Okay. The staff had indicated that we were going to, there were other slides we could go through on their listing recommendations. I don't know that we need to do that.
We seem to hit a downer note.
We won't hold you responsible. All right. I heard concerns about indicator bacteria. I would recommend in the staff report, page 25, anybody, there is a one-page explanation that addresses that to some degree. I think we've had comments made that, you know, we can call it indicator bacteria today and figure it out later, or there is question about, do we have the correct data to even put it in as a list at this point? So.
If I may, indicator bacteria is the term to capture the different kinds of bacteria that we are required to monitor for to meet the evaluation criteria and for our water quality standards. So I think it's simply a term to acknowledge the recognized bacteria that we monitor for, which are Enterococcus, fecal, and I'm forgetting one, total, which are, I mean, that's the standard throughout the state of California. That's the standard suite of what are called indicator bacteria, because they're not necessarily the pathogens we're concerned about. They're just the ones that we know how to monitor for and we use as a standardized approach. So this is, to me, in my mind, is just a very indicator bacteria, we just said instead of just bacteria, we said indicator bacteria. Just simply to be clearer, there really is no change in what we're talking about from if we just called it bacteria listing. So I would just recommend that the board accept that's just what it's called in the scientific literature these days and how I believe probably the rest of the listings for the state are being done as well.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to say I really don't have a problem with the term indicator bacteria. My point is that data got us in here. Data is going to get us out. I think that's true with Woolly Creek, by the way, too. This is all about data, and I think it's important to have good data. I think it's important to have reliable data that's got QAQC value. It's collected in under protocol in terms that we could rely on. That's what we build this whole house on. And that would be what I want. I think that we don't really have a lot of leeway given the listing policy of not listing these for indicator bacteria, and I'm actually fine with that. My caution is just that I think data needs to be robust, and I think it needs to be supportive, and I think that's the way we're going to get in and out of these listings. So I'm actually fine with the list as it is, and I could go forward with that.
Ms. Harris?
In regards to the financial state of our state, and mentions from folks that spoke before, in regards to listing something or not delisting something and having that robust data that we need, all of those things come backed solely with dollars behind them. Those things can't exist unless we have money to have staff in order to do the research, or the Forest Service has the money, or different groups have the money. And it appears right now that money is a weak commodity. And so my concern with either delisting or listing or holding true. One of my concerns is if we do make a mistake, or if we don't have substantial data to support a firm, robust request, then where will we be in that future for those folks who seek a delisting? I mean, we're already behind, and it appears as though because of staff and finances that we may get more and more behind. So I just want to make sure that what we do is hardcore. I mean, we have good, hard data, because if we can't undo it for a really long time, where do we leave the folks who are in that sphere that are dealing with these things on a daily basis?
Mr. Hales?
Maybe this is for our executive officer. We have an MOU drafted with the Forest Service committing both parties to developing temperature and shade monitoring programs for a temperature and shade monitoring program for Woolly Creek.
That is my understanding. It's the staffs of our staff and the Forest Service for Six Rivers has been working really hard over the last couple of years, but I believe right now we're in the final throes of approving an MOU to implement the Salmon TMDL and marry it, if you will, with the Forest Service's ongoing water quality program in that watershed. And in that is a discussion about how we will do monitoring for temperature and for shade in a holistic, looking at it as a watershed. And I guess it would be my expectation that out of that MOU will come a monitoring program or perhaps a better understanding on our part of what the Forest Service is already doing, and perhaps some coaching of the Forest Service of what kind of data would be useful, because staff doesn't feel there's a whole lot of data that we would need in order to make a decision that is different on Woolly Creek. The point is we simply don't have it right now, but I think there's a belief that in the next 2 years or before the next listing cycle, that data can be generated without a great deal of expense and is already planned. So the sense on Woolly Creek is we can get the data. With some data, we might well be able to come to a different conclusion. Right now, we don't have that data, but we have a plan to get it.
Okay, I'm really struggling with this one, because Dr. Sommerstrom, Mr. Schuler, Mr. Costales all have excellent points. Mm-hmm. And I have personal knowledge of that watershed, and I've been on the ground, and I've seen it, and I understand exactly where they're coming from. I also am well aligned with what staff is saying in terms of what our listing policy is. And primarily, I'm aligned with Mr. Noren. Data gets us in and data gets us out. What's adding the third layer of complexity to this is exactly what Ms. Harris is saying, that it's all going to boil down to dollars. Does the MOU that we have translate into dollars that we have appropriated that can go into on-the-ground monitoring that we can then in turn start getting some real information about Woolly Creek? I mean, is there some sort of guarantee that we're going to have by the next listing cycle? Yep, you bet, guys. When we talked about this, we have 3 years' worth of solid data, and this is what's happening in Woolly Creek.
You know, obviously the Forest Service can't make any commitment about funding levels any more than we can. So with that caveat said, probably yes. I mean, my expectation is that this has been important to people, and if it's important to people, then we prioritize it and we get to it. You know, money being there. And the thing I'd like to say about Woolly Creek is already listed. Yeah. So there is a certain burden of proof that whether that was right or wrong, mm-hmm. we're living with that today. So there is a procedure and a certain burden of proof that comes with the delisting that is part of the statewide 303D policy. So it just is one of those things that is, and the 303D process, certainly within my career, has morphed from something that was an extremely informal process that was done with very little data to one that is now very data-driven and has very explicit rules. So we've gone from something that was quite loosey-goosey to something now that's quite formalized, and that has had some consequences that perhaps sometimes seem absurd, but overall, I think that the process has improved a great deal over the past several years, in particular with the statewide listing policy. And sometimes we don't like the results of how that policy ends up, but they're the rules we're living within.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
Mr. Dunker.
Let me add another layer. Great.
Okay. Although it's not really going to confuse the matter, it's a torn issue with me also. It's like trying to balance a scale and to make a right decision in anticipation of what should be done here. And so, I realize both sides. My thoughts and concern is that we really make I make a decision on what is the right thing to do, whether there's money there or not. And I don't see enough conclusive evidence to change anything at this point. Go along with the recommendation. If being listed, continued with the listing, pushes us forth toward getting more data, I think it'll find a path one way or the other. Anyway, that's my feelings on it.
Mr. Corbett.
Yeah, I'm going to support this. I want to move on, but I really do think we probably would have needed a study session anyway on the priority issue. I'm convinced with the budget, we got a broken system here, and we need to find a fairly ruthless way, to be frank, to set priorities and to come up with different ways we can solve the problem, picking the biggest problems first and finding a way to trail off the smaller ones. And so I will be working with the executive officer on some ideas I have, and then I really think we need to have a study session on how we can make the TMDL process work the second we get the budget news, plus whatever time it takes staff to prepare.
Okay, Ms. Dean.
Well, I'd like to compliment staff for all the hard work that they've done, and also whoever put all that information on the website. Thank you. I use both the information we got as a hard copy, and I also use the website. And I found some of the information on the website very helpful. It helped me understand some of the issues that I was looking at here. I, too, feel that, you know, the data that we have supports everything that staff is telling us. But I have to agree with everyone else that we are going to have to look at what the implications are of what we're doing here. This has an impact on every citizen, and it also has an impact on other municipalities and counties as well, from very small little communities that have discharge permits like Ferndale to Santa Rosa. Ratepayers are wary. Voters are wary. Just look at what happened in the last election. So the idea that we can push this on to the permits may not be as feasible as we would like it. We're going to have to take a real hard look as to how we are going to fund our TMDLs and where that money's going to come from. I definitely agree with the priorities, and I, too, would support a study session as to how we're going to do this.
Okay. Any other board member comments? Staff comments? Mr. TMDL?
David Leland of your staff. I just wanted to briefly...
Your other name, right?
That's right. Briefly acknowledge... in response to Ms. Dean's comments, the hard work that Rebecca Fitzgerald put into this,
yes,
who was here earlier, and then the great work that Catherine Carter did in following up when Rebecca went out on maternity leave. Thank you.
And the cooperativeness of the young Fitzgerald, who was... They were in the hall a little while ago, but not at the moment. Okay, we have before us resolution. Pleasure of the board.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we affirm this resolution. Unfortunately, I've lost my place in the... This would be R1, 2009-0047.
I'll second.
We have an errata sheet.
Yeah. The board has in front of it a green sheet. Mm-hmm. And that, it's not to the resolution. It's, yeah, we have. Yeah. Including the errata. As the resolution, including modifications thereto. Including the errata sheet with the modifications for item number 2, pages 368. The two items.
Second is modified.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. Thanks all for coming. Some a long distance. And we... One other item.